Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Welcome to Way of the Dreamer. This is Robert Mouse. This is the show where we affirm the power of dreams, coincidence, and imagination to give us sources and resources for soul and for survival and for thriving in life beyond the obvious. We have a wonderful guest today. Her name is Sarah Jane. She's calling in from England, I think, at the moment, though she might be calling from Egypt or Greece or indeed from the dream world. She's a lifelong dream explorer and enthusiast. She's leading interesting workshops and conferences in various places. She has a book from one of my favorite publishers, Inner Traditions, called Initiation into Dream Mysteries, Drinking from the Pool of Mnemosyne, who you remember as the Mother of the Muses, and the title evokes something of those Orphic lamellae, you know, those gold leaf tablet sheets on which instructions for handling your entry into the Hellenic Bardo were written. Watch out for the pool on the left, go to the pool on the right by the white cypress, the pool of Mnemosyne, the pool of memory. And I think that one of the tasks that Sarah's given herself is to restore our memory of ways of dreaming and approaching the sacred and approaching healing that, you know, we forgot for a while. And her passion for the ancient world and its traditions shines through her book and, I think, her work. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you so much, Robert. It's an absolute pleasure to join you. I have long been a fan of your work, and I think there's a lot in your writings about your own dream experiences that I've always resonated with.
Well, you began early, too. You tell us you have been a dream enthusiast all your life. Tell us something from your early life about what drew you to this deep engagement with the dreaming.
I've wondered sometimes if it's a kind of genetic thing. I did actually notice, Robert, that your birthday is the day after mine, so I wonder whether there's an astrological significance there as well, perhaps. But most of my family are quite into their dreams, and a lot of us are left-handed. There's various kind of things that seem to kind of stand out quite often when you meet other people that have very vivid lucid dreams. I've often wondered about left-handedness, actually, whereby perhaps it increases brain connectivity in certain areas with regard to practicing writing. I've always written a lot and kept a dream diary and was really interested in drawing and painting and stuff when I was younger as well. And I've often wondered whether that kind of affects the kind of relationship you have with the imaginal. But, yeah, as I said, I remember dreams from being really young. And I met a woman recently. I did an interview with my friend Anthony Peake with a woman called Rebecca Sharrock, who's got highly superior autobiographical memory. I don't know if you've heard of this. It's a particular sort of superpower of memory, really. Often goes hand in hand with autism. And it means that people can remember pretty much everything that's ever happened to them really vividly as well. And Rebecca says that she thinks she can remember being in the womb. She's one of only about 70 people in the world who've actually been tested for this superpower. And she has this kind of like color-coded index system to retrieve memories. And I was sharing, you know, one of the things that I was most interested in discussing with her is her dream life, because of course if she can remember everything, I figured she would be lucid in all of her dreams as well. And we got talking about it, and she is lucid in all of her dreams. One thing I really wanted to ask her, because she can remember really early dreams, is I remember being a toddler, I guess, or a baby even, and having dreams where I was just in complete whiteness. And then as I got a bit older, these dreams started to fill in, and they would become more sort of detailed. It would start off with toys, actually, favorite toys and animals, and then other people. And she had these similar dream experiences of existing in this pure white space.
Are you still with us? The line seems to have gone silent. Is the call still going, Jack?
I'm still here.
Are you good? Well, suddenly things fell silent. It didn't sound as if you'd quite finished, but I have some comments to make, so let's carry on. When I was in my early teens, one of my invisible visitors, one of the visitors that other people didn't see, was a radiant youth, beautiful young man, from the eastern shores of the Mediterranean, somewhere like modern Syria or Lebanon. And he spoke to me in the Greek of the Neoplatonists, so I didn't know about them at the time. And he told me in Greek that all knowledge that matters comes through anamnesis, which is a term that's familiar to you, and it's increasingly familiar to English speakers, and it's in English dictionaries. But I didn't know at the time he told me this, that anamnesis, which literally means remembering, in the doctrine of Plato and the Neoplatonists and the doctrine of Pythagoras on a parallel, is about remembering the knowledge that you had before you came into the body this time round, and maybe going back through the golden chain of your lineage to previous lives and so on. So I started out, I mean, that wasn't the start of my engagement with dreaming, but I knew from that point on, that lived with me, lived in me very vividly. But it's all about memory. It's all about remembering. And when you talk about remembering what's in the womb, I was looking this week at a remarkable article by one of those eccentric but wonderful early American anthropologists. His name was John Peabody Harrington. And he traveled all over North America, particularly the Southwest, collecting the languages, recording the languages that were dying out or not dying out amongst Native Americans. And in Yuma territory, he met the best dreamer of the Yuma, he called him, and his English name was Joe Homer. There we go, Greek again. And Joe Homer told him that his training as a dreamer began in the womb when he would travel in and out of the womb, though usually he didn't travel very far because it was dark. And this dreamer of a Native American people proceeded to say, you see, all the best doctors, the word for dreamer and doctor are the same in this language, all the best doctors start in the womb so they don't have to catch up later on. They know a lot of it from early on. So it is about remembering by one means or another. And I would say that dreaming for me, and perhaps for you, is about soul remembering. It's about remembering the larger story. It's about remembering our soul family. It's about recognizing the lineages and cultures we are connected to. It's about hearing the ancestors in at least three ways. Ancestors of our bloodlines, ancestors of the lands where we live or visit, ancestors of cultural traditions that call us. When reading your book, I'm struck both by your passionate engagement with a number of ancient cultures, from ancient Sumer or Babylon to Egypt to Greece, of course, to Crete, and going all the way back to earlier civilizations, earlier cultures for which we don't have written language, back to Neolithic times, back earlier. And one of the questions that you confront early in the book when you're talking about, let's say, the days of the cave artist is, how can we know, we're going to write about what they're dreaming, how can we know what they're thinking, how can we know anything much about them when we don't have written records? And basically, it seems as if you've applied your ability to imagine things, to do true imagination, to delve into these cultures. You've studied the material records of the cultures. You've read the history and the anthropology and the archaeology, and you've tried to put yourself there. And then at the end of each of your chapters, you've given us an essay, an exercise in initiatic, you use, initiatic dreaming, in which you put us in the situation of a fictional character who is living, for example, a Mesopotamian priestess who was entertaining a horned viper at the start of the episode. You put us into their situation, and you try to show us how they experience things. Talk to us about this, and talk to us about your own practice in putting yourself in the presence of the entities and situations that you want to write about and want to know.
Well, I've always really loved reading novels and the imagination, and I'm sure you know yourself, when you're into dreams as a young child, you're drawn to any art, any media, any film, any TV show that's about dreams. They've always been my favourite. And one thing that I think happens when you read fiction is you have a more emotional engagement with that writing, you're able to put yourself into the position of a character. You have to conjure up your powers of imagination to kind of put yourself in that place. And you talk about active dreaming. There's a power in that active imagination whereby you are creating new things in your imaginal world, and therefore you are creating content that you can dream with later. So the idea for my book is that I wanted to give people the context of those time periods, but I also wanted to invite the reader to imagine themselves in that time period. And I think I find the same practice, like you illustrate a lot of your dreams. I like illustrating my dreams, and I think there's something different that happens when you draw and paint a dream, where you are kind of actively kind of reimagining that. And it's interesting that you talked about memory and how vital memory is for dreaming. This is something that I think is hugely underrated in the scientific study of dreaming, how incredible the powers of memory are in the dream state. I'm sure a lot of your listeners have had this experience of being in the dream state and remembering previous dreams that you don't have access to in your ordinary waking state. That's an incredible phenomena that's really common and regular. And just the fact that so many people wake up from dreams and they can't remember them tells us a lot about the memory involvement of dreaming. And I think that this is why mnemosyne, the personification of memory or divine remembrance in the ancient Greek tradition, fascinates me so much, because it's very interesting to me that she's the mother of the muses, as you say, because that she therefore is the source of all the inspiration in the world, because through her, the muses come to inspire humanity. And so I think there's a kind of inspiration that's been forgotten about, but that was understood by ancient Greek people. There's an inspiration that occurs in dreams. There's that aha moment that occurs in dreams when you become lucid, and that's the remembering. That kind of remembering is the remembering your place in the cosmic matrix somehow, and that's what we're all seeking. When I was a kid, I was obsessed with the idea that dreaming could provide me access to the afterlife, because I thought that if I could stay conscious and be lucid, then I would transcend death somehow. And I was also really interested in this idea of creating a machine that could record my dreams so I could play them as a film. So those kind of two things have really influenced my life, my journey, my career, everything that I've been doing. And I think that imagination is so important, and there's something like a kind of war on imagination at the moment, with the amount of incredibly uninteresting information that is produced by social media and how distracted and difficult people are to sleep, to access right. their dreams. I think that that's something that I'm very, very aware of as well.
Right. As you speak, in my line of sight on my computer from some notes I was pulling together just now, is a quote from Philostratus, who you know about, on the imagination. "Nothing can stop the imagination," he writes, "for it proceeds undismayed to the goal which it has itself conceived." I mean, so there is a big testimonial to the power of imagination in the language and with the clarity which we need to restore. When you talk about memory in relation to dreaming and how memory is accomplished through dreaming, I'm thinking how different the autobiographies, if one can use that word, of indigenous people and those of modern people are. I was rereading an article by Halliwell, who is an anthropologist who was amongst the Ojibwa from some time, and he read a passage about what an Ojibwa's idea of Native Americans' idea of autobiography is. Of course, autobiography isn't the right word, because there's no concept of linear time in the language, so it's all very different. But the interesting point that Halliwell made, as someone living close to the people but an outsider, is they don't distinguish between dreams and waking event in terms of what is important and what is real. As a matter of fact, when they tell their stories, the dreams seem to be more real and more important than the waking incidents. Of course, Jung was like that. You read Memories, Dreams, Reflections. It's quite clear that for Jung, the big dreams and the big cases of active imagination were as important or more important than any of the external circumstances of his life. And that has been so for me, too. I wrote a memoir called The Boy Who Died and Came Back, which is very much about that. Let's talk about some of the things in your book, once again, as title is Initiation into Dream Mysteries. You touch on some things and evoke some things that, among my favorites when I think about dreaming in the ancient world. For example, you give a few pages to Gula, also known as Bao, as in Bao Wow, who might be my favorite deity from the Mesopotamian world, a dog goddess who has dogs all over her sanctuaries, serves lots of beer. Most people don't know about her, but she's a fantastic, fantastic form of a deity of healing. Just talk to me about Gula and about your own feelings and impressions of her.
Well, this is something that's really interested me with regards to ancient ideas about healing, because I think there was a much more holistic approach to healing in the ancient world, generally speaking. We often think about medicine in the ancient world as being fairly primitive, but if you look at something like the Sanctuary of Asclepius, it was a really sophisticated holistic healing center. And I guess the regard that ancient people had for the existence of a soul meant that they approached healing differently. And I think this is something that we could do well to return to these days, to think about healing mind, body, and spirit when we enter a healing sanctuary. And Gula is a very ancient goddess. She's one of the earliest goddesses in the Sumerian pantheon. She's associated with gods. She has an astrological component as well, as a lot of the ancient goddesses do. So she relates to the dog star. And there's an idea that charms and amulets could be put under the stars during certain astronomical activity to increase the efficacy of their cure, so they would be charged up, if you like, by this star power. And to me, Gula represents this goddess that can control chaotic forces, and disease and illness was seen as being a chaotic force, and most illnesses and diseases were seen to come from outside influences, in the same way that we have sort of shamanic healing techniques in indigenous populations today. There's this idea that illness comes upon someone, often via ill winds, because demonic beings in Sumer are perceived as being spirits of the wind or spirits of air, which is why you can dispel them using divine smoke, such as frankincense or other incenses. So if you do perceive an illness as coming from outside, then the goddess Gula is a taming force. She's a goddess that, like a dog, will ferociously protect you. So often people would wear dog amulets to protect them. They would often bury dog statuettes in every corner of the foundations of a building, for example. So Gula had temples that were dedicated to healing. They would train up physicians and surgeons. They had like a vast pharmacopoeia. They knew about the properties of all sorts of herbs and plants. And they even practiced things like euthanasia, for example, and they had very sophisticated healing techniques. And one thing that was important in terms of Sumerian healing and healing in the Near East was messages that would come through in dreams. So very often there was an idea that you were under the protection of your personal gods at birth, and you were, depending upon the time of your birth, the season of your birth, you would be allotted personal gods. And illnesses and diseases were often thought to come in when your personal gods were angry with you. So there was a multi-pronged attack on illness. You had a physical doctor, the Asu, and the Ashipu, who was the spirit doctor, who could work out what you've done to offend your personal gods. So it's a really interesting thing to look at in terms of the approach to illness, and obviously in many instances this approach was effective for people.
Well, that's great. Thank you for that, and thank you for writing about her. We need to know her better. I remember leading a group dream archaeology expedition in which we used shamanic drumming, having set the scene fairly carefully to go and explore somewhere. And I led a group to the sanctuary, the doghouse, the sacred doghouse of Gula in a sacred city.
Wow.
I think it was called Isin. And people loved it. I mean, they loved it. We did a number of journeys in that particular workshop to other... I have a strong Mesopotamian connection, too, have had since my earliest boyhood. But, you know, we did other things. You know, we went to meet, you know, we did the descent of the Inanna, for goodness sake. It was a long program. But the thing that people loved most was going to Gula's sanctuary. They loved the dogs. They loved the combination of medical and spiritual approaches. They loved the presence of the goddess herself. Sarah, have you been to the Wellcome Library in London? Because they have a wonderful statue of Gula there. I've seen photographs, but I haven't seen the actual thing. They have a wonderful modern image of Gula, which I love, with a dog. So I know you like museums. When I see your pictures that you post, of your visits to museums, I see the informed eye, and I also see, frankly, the hungry eye, the eye that brings things alive through its yearning. I mean, Jung said that looking psychologically brings about the activation of the object, you know. And I sometimes feel, from the way you look at statues and take their pictures, you're actually participating in bringing them alive, putting the rock crystal or the obsidian back in the empty eye sockets and bringing them alive. So if you haven't seen it physically, you're in an easier position than me to go see Gula at the Wellcome Medical Library in London.
Oh, I have seen Gula in there in the past. They're closed to the they've closed part of it for a while, I think. I'm not sure whether it's reopened, but that's an amazing, wonderful thing that you said there, because that's exactly how I feel. When I see statues of gods and goddesses that I adore, I try to communicate that power and that energy in them. And I've got a very good friend who's an ancient art researcher who specializes in cave art and in things like Göbekli Tepe and statues in ancient Anatolia. And he gave a fantastic talk for my lecture club about that statues can be infused with spirit, that they were seen as being living in the ancient world. And when you think about the amount of care and attention and appreciation ancient statues have, I want to give some of that back.
All right. No Like a Passion here. We're talking to Sarah Janes, author of Initiation into Dream Mysteries, leader of dream workshops and dream conferences and dream expeditions, particularly of late to Greece. We'll be back to talk to her more after the break. You're listening to Way of the Dreamer. This is Robert Moss.
Where can you find out about dreams and the dream world? MossDreams.com. At MossDreams.com, you can find out about Robert Moss, his work, and discover the way of the dreamer. Read numerous articles and essays on almost every facet of dreams. Find out Robert's class and workshop schedule. Read reviews and so much more. Visit MossDreams.com to find your way of the dreamer. That's MossDreams.com.
Robert Moss has a deep engagement with the dream world, and now you can take a crash course from this master of active dreaming at your own pace. That's right. You can get Robert's 8 exciting half-hour programs on a new DVD set called Way of the Dreamer. Share Robert's story as a dreamer and dream healer. This dynamic 3-DVD set can help teach you how to find your way through your dreams to realize your full potential. Don't wait to learn the practical dreamwork techniques that can help you understand how to attain better health, emotional stability, spiritual awareness, and more. Order Way of the Dreamer DVDs today from Amazon.com or MossDreams.com. That's MossDreams.com.
We're HealthyLife.net, reaching and helping a worldwide audience without hype, without shock, and without shenanigans.
Welcome back. This is Way of the Dreamer with Robert Noss. Our wonderful guest today is Sarah Janes. Her book is Initiation into Dream Mysteries. We're getting ready to talk about statue magic. It's something that you notice throughout the ancient world, and you notice it in many living polytheistic traditions today, in Hinduism, in Santeria, in other traditions that have deities, orishas, demigods, are actively worshipped. I mean, something is done to call a spirit, a soul, a power into a physical form, and then people have relations with it, and they have relations with it on different levels. In the Hellenistic tradition that Sarah knows well, there are different levels to this. It can be low goetia, rather low sorcery, or it can be Neoplatonism and theurgy and efforts to divinize the individual and put yourself in the realms of higher powers. Telestike was a Greek word for this, animating a statue. And you see it all over, and in Egypt, where it's very much practiced, in Egypt, the sculptor himself, or it's usually himself, is called one who keeps alive, or one who brings alive. And in the fictional section at the end of your Mesopotamian chapter, Sarah, which I referred to earlier, you describe bringing or keeping a statue of a divinity alive. You describe its feeding, its anointing, and this is a constant practice. So, and this, of course, interacts with dreaming because we know, you know, particularly from the Asclepian testimonials, which you know a good deal about, we know that people expected in their dreams and in their personal revelations to see the deities in the forms that were being represented in the sculptures. So the deities have taken on to some extent a fairly fixed form, and people expect to see Asclepius as a golden ivory living being. So talk to us about your own impressions as you stand with the statues, as you've done in many sites and museums, and your own impression of what is going on in the spiritual experience, whether we call it dreaming or imagination or sacred encounters, with the people in the cultures that put so much effort into ensouling statues and keeping them alive.
Yes, statue magic. I think there are certain statues for me that seem to have this special power. One that I noticed recently was a statue, a bronze of Artemis in the Piraeus Archaeological Museum. It was just incredible. It looked like she was going to come to life any moment. And given the amount of kind of decay that statue had gone through, it was quite incredible. The British Museum, I love the British Museum because it's a very close museum to where I live. I go every single time I go up to London, pretty much. And even though I've gone as often as I have, there are still rooms that I haven't yet explored. The other day, my daughter was with me and she wanted to do a whistle-stop tour of every single room because she'd never been in every single room before. And she ran off, and in the process of looking for her, I realized that there were whole sections that I'd never been in before. But there are some extraordinary statues at the British Museum. And I love kind of going up to them with this sense of trying to get myself into the headspace of ancient people, like feeling the energy and the power with them and anticipating their movement. Actually, there's something for me about when I'm with a statue, when I'm engaged with it, that I anticipate. And I think there is something about a statue whereby it facilitates the projection of attention and appreciation. And I think that's why ancient people created statues, so they could fine-tune and focus their attention and appreciation to praise something, to adore something, and to ask and petition a god for something. It makes it so much easier when there's a real-world physical target for your desire. So often as well, some of the statues that we see, if you go to, for example, the wonderful new Acropolis Museum that's just been built, there's some beautiful statues of corps of girls that have the original paint on them, and you can see how colourful and beautiful and living these statues would have looked to ancient people, whereas quite often we're seeing a kind of bleached, pure white version of the statues, which is not very realistic. But I think some sculptors are possessed by the muses when it comes to creating that sense of animation in their work.
Yeah, people are shocked when they see a reproduction of what statues probably looked like when they were painted and had, you know, eyeballs made of some kind of rock crystal or obsidian or something in the eye sockets. And they're even more shocked, actually, when you can take them in active imagination or active dreaming, as I call it, to those sites to see how they might have been. One of my teachers, active dreaming, led a group journey to the temple of Khonsu, a moon deity at Karnak recently, and he took 20 people with him, the shamanic drumming. They're going to the site, and one of them saw, this is really interesting, one of them saw Khonsu's statue come alive fully and then divide into like 20 miniature Khonsus who go off to do individual healing work and individual actions and individual situations. And I think that's actually a very valid vision today through a modern, what I call a dream archaeology expedition, of what things might have been like. And it reminds me of episodes in my, and I'm going to tell you one if I may, involves everyday statue magic. So a family comes to me years ago. There's a lot of trouble in the family, and there's a 9-year-old daughter who's terrified every night and has no coherent account of her dream. So I can't simply say, well, take an aloe and go back into your dream and face the monster. It's all formless. It's night terrors. It probably reflects psychological dysfunction and psychic disorder in the house in the neighborhood. So I reach, I mean, I'm a boy, I've still got toy soldiers. I pull out a Roman soldier. It's a Roman centurion that I have in my collection. I give it to her, and I say, this will be your guardian of the night. Any night that you feel there's trouble, call on this soldier, and he's going to protect you. 3 years later, at a social event, barbecue, something, a picnic, something like that, she comes up and says, Lex is great, and I have no idea what she's talking about. She's somewhat disappointed that I don't remember. She's named the soldier Lex. She reminds me I gave her a miniature statue as a guardian of the night, and she says, Lex is wonderful. He's 10 feet tall. If there are any bad things in the night, Lex is there, and he doesn't let them through. So I thought, listening to this and looking at this, this stuff really works. I mean, it was simply the power of intention, of wishing, wanting a guardian for the night. It didn't require any food or incense or anything else, but the act of wishing made the toy soldier a focusing device by which an entity beyond the soldier and beyond simply intention could come and be available in the night as a guardian for a young child who was in psychic danger. So, you know, I saw it on that occasion. And, of course, I've seen it in relation to the big statues, the ancient statues. One has to be careful what one does around them. I've had experiences involving that kind of thing, too. All interesting stuff. The way that humans encounter the more than human and the way that human imaginations give shape to those larger powers, I mean, is really part of the story of religion. Almost as important, but not nearly as important, and this is something that speaks to something you were talking about earlier, is the fact that dreaming is probably the number one source of the human belief that there is a soul that survives death and goes to some kind of an afterlife, because we've dreamed it. We've met the departed in our dreams, and we've gone there. We've gone traveling in our dreams. You say as a child you wanted to experience that, you wanted to know it. Well, for me, it wasn't something I had to seek. I mean, I've been dreaming with the dead all my life because I died and came back starting at age 3. But, you know, and the ancients understood this. This is what the early anthropologists, like Sir Edward Tyler at Oxford, first professor of anthropology, found remarkable and wrote about in The Language, the racist language of their time, by saying these savage witch doctors were ahead of our science because they knew something about how the soul travels beyond the body. All right, we're talking to Sarah Janes. Her book is Initiation of Dream Mysteries. We've got lots more to cover. We'll be back in a moment after the break. This is Way of the Dreamer with Robert Muff.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you are interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com. Get your personal dream symbols and discover the ones you dream about in Linda McKenzie's Symbols of You, a new book available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target, and more.
You're listening to HealthyLife.net, the radio network that brings positive talk with positive change to make your world a little better.
We're back with Sarah Janes. Sarah, how do people reach you? What is your website?
TheMysteries.org.
Say it one more time.
TheMysteries.org.
Okay. Now, you and I are both enthusiasts, I believe, for the hypnagogic state. I mean, that's what the sleep researchers call it, the liminal state between sleep and awake, to which amazingly little coverage has been given in the vast history of research and writing about sleep and dreams. I'm constantly astonished. I should look at myself, because although I write about it, talk about it all the time, and have gained from it all of my life, probably more than from any other state of consciousness, I haven't devoted a book to it. But I think from time to time in your book, you talk about how a certain kind of experience, which we too hastily label lucid dreaming, though it can be called lucid dreaming, but a certain kind of experience is being accomplished in a liminal state, that in-between state. And certainly in the Asclepian experience, to judge from the testimonies and from Ilias Aristides, a lot of good stuff of encountering the god or his consort or his children took place when people were neither awake nor asleep, but in this numinous, fertile space in between. What's your own experience of that? How do you operate in that space, and what can you more can you tell us about how important it may have been in ancient times?
I think that one of the things I'm very interested in with regards to ancient Greek perception of the world and of reality is the power of the Greek myths at the time, the kinds of stories and the personifications that made up the pantheon. And I think that there was a kind of mythic cognition, if you like, amongst ancient Greek people, where they understood these stories, and therefore the characters in these stories and these stories would often work their way into their dreams. And for example, if you take a pilgrim visiting the sanctuary of Asclepius, where you're kind of primed to expect an encounter with the god, I think that there's a sort of auto-suggestion and what you might even call something like kind of hypnagogic experience. When people are sleeping in the Abaton, there's probably a fumigation of opium. There is the suggestion that you're going to be visited by serpents. There are serpents slithering on the floor around you. Asclepius, that's his sacred precinct. He can appear to you in dreams. And there are statues of Asclepius everywhere. There are testimonies all covering the walls, telling you that previous pilgrims have had these incredible encounters with the god. I think that would have had an incredibly powerful effect. And when I do my tours, I take people to the sanctuary of Asclepius. You can sleep in the lower level of the Abaton. Quite often we're not disturbed because it's part of this fantastic sanctuary, which includes the great theatre of Epidavros. And so when coachloads of tourists arrive, they're often just shown the theatre and perhaps the museum and don't really go into the sanctuary in any great depth. So very often we've had this amazing kind of sleeping divine dream dormitory all to ourselves. So when I take my my pilgrims there, I do a kind of hypnotic suggestion of imagining themselves visiting this place in ancient times and the sorts of experiences they could expect. And that really does seem to kind of prime them to have dreams of Asclepius, to have dream encounters with Asclepius. And if you think that that can be achieved with a hypnotic suggestion in the ruins of a place, then I can only imagine how much more likely and vivid those dreams would be if you were there at the time when you're surrounded by these, like, you know, there was a fantastic statue of Asclepius at the sanctuary there, which was a Proselephantine statue, so made out of gold and ivory, huge statue. And you kind of think about the awe-inspiring nature of that site. The whole place kind of feels like a divine city. It's encircled by the sacred grove, and that sacred grove represents passing from the human world of mortals into this divine space. And I think there's something about, with regards to the sorts of healing that was occurring here, because people were performing, there were physicians working there, they were performing operations, amputations, giving herbal remedies, all sorts of real physical material world treatments, but they also gave a lot of importance to healing the soul and the mind and the spirit, and that could be achieved through divine dreams and psychodrama in the theatrical performances that would take place as well.
Yeah, you're a lyrical exponent of that site. It's wonderful when we can go to one of these sites and escape the tourists and have access to places where something good can happen. I had that experience at Pergamon some years ago. I led a group to Pergamon. We went to the Asclepian, and we had sole access to the store of the Abaton. I mean, not because we'd arranged it. We just so happened. There's no one around. So I got people to spread out, and I drummed for them. So we did, you know, we did it. We did a little shamanic dreaming. And then, this was really the clincher. Now we could just cross over the way, it wasn't far at all, to the theater of the Asclepion. And I had people perform very quick versions of the visions they had received in the Avaton. By this point, groups of tourists were appearing. Fortunately, the first group was Australian. And they're very proud that an Aussie's doing something. Oh, good on you, mate. The Turkish guides all wanted to know how you can do this, what's going on. But, I mean, what a gift that was to actually have the soul of the Avaton to ourselves for long enough to be able, to be not interfered with when I'm drumming for people to go into the dreams of that place and dreams of their own psyche, and then perform it. Because, of course, the performance is essential. And I don't know whether you know more about this than I do, but I'm quite certain that there was performance of the personal dreams and visions that we received. We know that after the experience with the deity or the messenger in the sanctuary, that people would come out and sit in some kind of throne of memory and be expected to tell their stories. And I bet that in what is still a predominantly oral culture, telling the story meant moving your hands, moving your body, and more than that, maybe letting other people come and help you enact it. So there's all the theater by the dramatists going on, and all the low comedies and farces, but I bet there was a good deal of performance on a more intimate scale of the stories that people were getting and stories were living. To every day there's a story, and to every night, said Elias Aristides. So story-making, storytelling, is very much part of this pattern of healing. So we're talking to Sarah Janes. There is so much to talk about. She has written a book which takes us into ancient cultures and shows us against the backdrop, against the context of their social institutions, their religions, their deities, their agricultural lack of it, shows us how they dreamed and might have dreamed. I find the same dilemma, Sarah, looking at records of dreams as looking at cultures that didn't yet have a language that we can understand. Because if I have a inscription, I've looked at all the Hittite dream inscriptions, for example, Queen Paduhipa's and all the others. We've got broken, short statements. How do we know what is really going on? How can we make sense of this? You know, that requires an active imagination, doesn't it? I mean, which clearly you accomplish when you go and you write these novelistic codas to each chapter. But I wouldn't say that we cannot access these things. I think if we're prepared to learn to be dream archaeologists and use the skills of what I would call shamanic dreaming beyond lucid dreaming, and you might call lucid dreaming, to go into these things and compare and checking and testing and verifying, we can bring back more than people might have thought possible. I think you're helping to do that. We'll have to take a break. I don't want to start up again and then get cut off. So let me say once again, we're talking to Sarah Janes. Her current book is Initiation in Dream Mysteries. We have lots more to explore, and let me say, as a former junior lecturer of ancient history as well as an active dreamer, I love the combination of history and dreaming. Back after the break.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you are interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
Welcome back. This is Where the Dream with Robert Moss. We're having a very good time. My guest is Sarah Jane. She's taken up a cause that I espoused when I wrote my book, The Secret History of Dreaming, which is to give us some more information about the central role of dreaming and imagination in the human enterprise all the way through the Odyssey on the planet. So let's get up close and personal. I want to know about your dreaming practice. I want to know about how you dream, how and when you record, what's the difference between lucid and other forms of dreaming for you, because everybody's beating the drum of lucid dreaming these days, and I still have some questions about that. My first book was called Conscious Dreaming, not Lucid Dreaming, for certain reasons that haven't altogether evaporated. So tell me a bit about your dreaming practice, daily basis, weekly basis, journaling, jump in wherever you like.
I'm very much interested in dream incubation these days. I mean, one of the reasons why I got especially interested in researching lucid dreaming was because I'd always been a lucid dreamer. I can't remember a time when I didn't lucid dream. And dreams have always been this kind of incredibly rich tapestry running through my life. And I thought it was very interesting what you were saying earlier about this more kind of perhaps ancient or indigenous idea about dreaming being part of true reality and some dreams being more real than what we would call waking reality. And I do think, like in the Australian tradition, that there's a continuum of consciousness and dreams are part of that fabric and they can't be discounted. And it's really important that we can engage consciously with dreams because they help us learn about ourselves and they help us grow and evolve. So the reason why I was so interested in writing and learning and lecturing about dreaming was because when I had my daughter when I was 30, I didn't sleep enough. And I was didn't really have insomnia, but just couldn't sleep, wasn't getting the same kind of quality of dreams that I was before. And I was absolutely heartbroken, and I didn't feel like myself at all. And then after about 2 years, the lucid dreaming returned, and I was so grateful and appreciative and happy of it, and I recognized how deeply it enriches my life. I wanted to kind of spread the word. You know, I was an advocate for lucid dreaming from that point. And then I host a lecture series in my hometown of Hastings, and I have all sorts of interesting guests, sort of neuroscientists, people researching psychedelic drugs, sociologists, psychologists, ancient historians, and one of my lecturers was Dr. David Luke, who's a senior psychologist lecturer at the University of Greenwich, and we were talking about lucid dreams. He was giving a talk about DMT, I think, and the sorts of entities that you see on DMT. And we got onto the subject of lucid dreaming, and he was telling me that he'd recently visited, you know, the Lydney Park sleep temple in Britain, dedicated to the Celtic deity Nodan. And he was telling me about visiting that site with a shaman from Mexico. And then it was a penny-dropping moment where I realized, because I've always been fascinated by ancient cultures, I love ancient languages, ancient hieroglyphic scripts, and ancient religions and gods and goddesses, and I thought I could just combine those interests and forge a little niche for myself.
And okay, Sarah, when you look over it all, what is a turning point dream? Give me a turning point dream from your life, which actually changed things for you.
My powerful lucid dreams are these dreams where I have cosmic experiences. I had a dream once where I was in the shower and a pocket of kind of cosmic dust opened up in the corner and it expanded and I had this sense of awe and I had this message. Quite often I receive messages in my dreams or phrases that are important. And this one was telling me that there was a black hole on a butterfly's wing and I saw a morpho butterfly. There's kind of a theme, like quite often there's encounters with deities. I've had a dream where I met the god of the sun, Ahura Mazda, on the landing of my old house. And I mean, that dream was quite a turning point dream actually. And it married this idea of how dreams could potentially kickstart self-healing mechanisms actually. So that's quite a good one. So in this dream, I was standing on the landing of my childhood home. And Ahura Mazda descended from the heavens, and he was this fantastic being of light. And then you know in dreams how you can see kind of close up and far away at the same time. You have this kind of omnipotent vision. So I could see the image of the God descending as this being of light, but simultaneously I could see my DNA structures inside of my body, and I could see the spiral of DNA untwisting to form a staircase that Ahura Mazda could walk down. And as he stepped onto the rungs of my DNA, he was like lighting every step. And so that, for me, was quite a powerful dream in terms of dream medicine. It made me feel amazing in the moment because it was lucid. And it did give me the sense of how dreams could heal people spontaneously as a sort of faith healing, a deep faith healing effect. Because I do think that we also have certain genes that are switched on when we're asleep that are involved in homeostasis, that are involved in those self-regulating mechanisms that help us detoxify, that help us renew cells. And if you think that the experience that you're having in a dream in that moment, if that's a really profound, deep healing experience, then the mechanisms in your body, I think, are going to be like activated and responding in a way that matches that healing effect. So I think that, as well as there being all sorts of material healing modalities practiced at the Asclepians, for example, that a divine dream where the God came to you and healed you by, I don't know, putting some like radiant balm over your body, or by chopping off your head, tipping it up beads and sewing your head back on, this could be met somehow by self-healing mechanisms, by your body responding in a way. I often compare it actually to when people have orgasms in dreams in response to erotic dream sequences. Your body is biologically and biophysically responding to dream stimuli.
Oh, I think there's no doubt these days that the body believes in images, so this kind of stuff can feed in immediately. My favorite account of Asclepian healing from Epidaurus is involved a woman from Sparta named Arata, and it involves mutual visioning at a distance, because she came on behalf of her daughter, who's in Sparta, suffering from a condition which the old translations call dropsy. And Arata goes into the abaton, and she dreams, and she meets Asclepius, who cuts off her head, holds her upside down, and all sorts of putrid stuff comes out. The same night, she discovers later, the daughter in Sparta has had the same dream. Oh, and puts her head back on afterwards, and then things are fine. The daughter dreams that this has been done to her. Her head's been chopped off and put back on, and things are fine, and the healing has come through. Well, it's one of those testimonials that might be too good to be true, but it's very interesting to think that there is the claim of dreaming at a distance, which is also mutual interactive dreaming. You're in the sanctuary of the God, but you're all reaching them, and it's producing results. So those testimonials, and we have that huge collection by the Edelsteins done early on and republished by Johns Hopkins to look at. It's well worth studying if you want to see how imagery can affect the body. Well, unfortunately, we're near the end of this show. We'll be really just coming back with Sarah Jane to say thank you and dream on. I loved your story of the dream of the staircase of the DNA and the staircase between the worlds. The Neoplatonists would probably have liked this as an example of the small and the great mirroring each other. The soul of the world, Sika Cosmu, being reflected on the scale of the body's own systems. You're listening to Way of the Dream with Robert Moss. We'll be back briefly after the break.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you're interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. mossdreams.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
You've been listening to Way of the Dreamer. Please pop over to mossdreams.com. You'll see I'm leading some actually rather exciting programs, mostly online, but a couple of ones at magical places. Sarah leads interesting things all over the place. Sarah Jane's author of Initiation into the Dream Mysteries. Thank you for coming and sharing your passion for the ancient dreaming, Sarah.
Thank you so much, Robert. It was an absolute pleasure. Very happy to have not met you in person, but spoken to you in person.
All right. To everyone, may your best dreams come true, and may you remember them.